Hello. We're here in Hotel Ritz in Madrid with Paul Cotton. Paul Cotton is some of the people in charge of the W3C working group working with HTML5 in relation with Microsoft. We would like to start this interview with the first question in relation with Jean-Paul's participation in XML, because if I remember correctly, the first approach that Microsoft did going to the standards, it was in relation with XML. Can you tell us something more about that?
Yes, and in fact, I was actually at IBM at the time that the XML work was getting started. And I worked in the database field. And of course, adding the capability of structured documents and structured text to databases has turned out to be a very important area. So while Jean and Tim, who I know personally, in fact, Tim and I go back, we're both Canadians, we've worked together in Canadian industry in the SGML area long before we all started doing XML. And so I was actually working in the XML area from when I was at IBM before I joined Microsoft. And in fact, that's where I first started to work at the World Wide Web Consortium, because I was the founding chair of the XML Query Working Group, which actually built on the XML work that you were just referring to. But I think that's a very important characteristic of the W3C, that it brings all of those communities together. So it brings the academics together, and in the case of industry, the example that you gave of XML was Microsoft and what then eventually became Mozilla, or Netscape at the time. But we have that same circumstance in the HTML working group today. So we have all five of the very large user agents, the browser vendors, at the table. But as well, we have a large number of invited experts, web developers. We have accessibility experts who are really interested in ensuring that websites are accessible to people with perhaps low vision or maybe even color problems in their vision. So I think that you're exactly right. Bringing those communities together so that they can work together is a very important aspect of gaining interoperability. And I think it's fair to say that one of the areas that is the roots of the work that we're doing in the browser space today goes all the way back to that XML work, and even the work that was occurring at the same time on HTML4.
Yeah.
All right, because of course that's why we have HTML5 today, is that HTML4 was a W3C recommendation in the late 90s at the same time that XML was actually being done.
What happened to XHTML2.0? Was it too ambitious or maybe too unacceptable? I'm talking about backwards compatibility.
You know, I'm Darwinian when it comes to doing interoperability and standards. You know, Charles Darwin came up with this concept of evolution, and when it comes to technical specifications, I sometimes think they go the same way. You know, we have very, very good ideas. Some of them survive, some of them don't, all right? I think basically what you saw in the W3C was that you had this large XML-oriented group of people, and you had the people that were more what I would call browser-centric, the HTML camp, and in some ways they went off in two different directions, all right? And I think that there's a lot of companies today that still use XML very heavily in production systems, you know, for document production. And I think the assumption was, because of the early adoption and use of SGML and then XML, that should be the way the web would go, which is, therefore, you get a group of people thinking that XHTML is the right way to go. And I think that I think it's fair to say that W3C perhaps made a mistake by concentrating so many of its resources around XHTML, and they didn't do a new version or very much maintenance on HTML for quite some time. Some of the members went outside W3C, started to do that work in what's called the What Working Group, but four years ago, the W3C decided that, you know, maybe the HTML and all the efforts that were going into what we now call HTML5 were becoming so important that they should bring the prodigal son back into the family. All right, and after that happened, that was when Microsoft actually joined the effort to define HTML5, and so now you had the full community at the table, which is your earlier point about the strength of W3C is bringing the community together. And so once we got the community all together again, then it seemed like the whole project just flourished. And at that point, the W3C, which, like any other organization or company, only has limited resources, had to decide where it was going to spend its resources. And one of the things they decided to do was to concentrate on their efforts to define what they now call generally the open web platform, which includes HTML5 and a lot of other specifications. And they simply decided that there was less need to do more work on XHTML. I will point out, though, that HTML5, the specification, does actually provide developers with the option of publishing websites in a format that is both XHTML compatible and HTML compatible. We call that the polyglot format. So if you think about it in mathematical terms, you have the HTML specification and the XHTML specification, and there's an overlap between the two. And if you use that overlap in a very rigorous way, you can actually have your website parsed and handled as if it was XHTML as well as it was HTML. So in some ways, although the W3C has officially announced that they aren't doing more work on like an HTML3 or an XHTML4, we've managed to bring those communities together so that it is possible for people to build websites that use both technologies.
In a previous interview to Philippe Legard, you mentioned that sometimes people refer to HTML5 and include technologies that are not being standardized. Is that the situation in these days?
This is a very difficult question because, of course, HTML5 is a brand or a name that is really not well understood. And it's one of the reasons why the W3C uses the more general phrase open web platform. Because I'm co-chair of the HTML working group in the World Wide Web Consortium, and we're responsible for the HTML5 specification. But you don't develop websites without CSS, without many of the other APIs that are actually done in some of the other working groups in the W3C. So I think what I was trying to express was the idea that there's going to be an ever-increasing number of these specifications. I think it's very important for developers to know that the specifications aren't even all done at the W3C. A perfect example of that is WebSockets, perhaps one of the most innovative parts of HTML5. It allows communications between the client and server to go in both directions, whereas with HTTP today, it's really only client to server. And I think there's a large array of new applications that will come about because of WebSockets. But the protocol work on WebSockets is done in IETF. It's only the API work that's actually done in W3C. So I think it's very important for people to sort of understand the various aspects of all of these specifications. But even more importantly is to understand their stability. And HTML5 today is not even at what we call last call in the W3C. Some parts of it are more stable. Some parts of it are implemented in multiple different browser implementations, but some parts of it are very new. So I think that this desire to continue to add things, I think it's very important for people to measure not whether these specs are part of HTML5, but even more importantly, how stable they actually are, so that if web developers are going to use them, they know that they can use that same content across multiple different browsers.
Sometimes when there's no clear consensus, the working group has to decide according to something called the decision policy. And are there voting, and how democratic is that decision policy?
This is a very interesting question, because when your city council decides that they're going to build a new road, if there's 11 councilmen, they might take a vote. It's 7-4, and you're done. All right, it passes, and you move on. The W3C, in the spirit of Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who's the founding director and still the director today, is a consensus-based organization, which actually means that the role of someone like myself as co-chair and my two co-chairs is to attempt to find the solution that causes the least amount of dissent. And the decision policy that you're referring to is our attempt to manage a very large working group, over 420 people in the working group, some of whom are very vocal, some of whom are much quieter. And so it's very important for us to have a procedure that allows us to move the various bugs and issues through steps so that everybody understands exactly what that decision policy is. And we do that by basically asking for change proposals, asking for counter proposals. And then we do online web surveys that everyone can respond to. And the chairs of the working group have made it very clear that when we're looking for consensus, we don't count votes. We're actually looking for the strength of the technical arguments. So it's very possible that somebody could offer a very compelling reason why something is broken in the specification, and they might be the only person to actually put forward that position. But if it's a very compelling technical argument, then the chairs are going to give that a lot of weight, because in effect it would cause a strong dissent for us to go against a very strong technical argument. This is one of the difficult parts about working at W3C. It's really up to the chairs to try and find that consensus. And it's one of the reasons we have three co-chairs in such a large working group, because all three of us bring different skill sets, different knowledge to a very rich set of specifications that the working group is working on.
I believe in the working group there is something called Bookzilla. Bookzilla would be something like a place where you settle for mistakes or books or things like that. But those mistakes are conceptual mistakes, architectural mistakes. How are you able to detect such a situation?
So we use a software tool called Bugzilla, all right, to allow people to actually file bugs. All right, and it's part of that decision policy. In fact, it's open to anyone. So when we get the HTML5 specifications to what we call last call, which is when the W3C really is after wide public comment on the specifications, you can treat the specification like a beta. A software beta, well, the specification needs to go through a beta phase as well. And it's very easy for someone to just apply for an account at W3C and then be able to enter bugs directly into Bugzilla. And then we track those bugs as part of that decision policy to make sure that the editor of the appropriate specification, because we have 9 different specs in the HTML working group, the editor is responsible for triaging the bugs to begin with. A little bit like when you arrive at emergency, there's a triage nurse that says, oh, this one's more important than that one. So that's the role of the editor initially, is to try and evaluate those bugs. Some of them are completely editorial. The word it occurs twice. It says it. Well, that's a typing mistake, you know. So those ones are very easy. Some of them may be asking for a new feature. Some of them may be asking to change how browsers or user agents actually respond to different HTML syntax. So the bugs are processed by the editors initially, and the editor responds directly on the bug, and we hope that the correspondent, the person that actually filed the bug, they receive an email when the bug is updated. And so there's a dialogue that goes on back and forth between the original person and the editors. And the working group is watching this as well. So it's very possible that a third party, who may not have filed the bug at all, will then get engaged in the dialogue and say, oh, well, I have an opinion that, you know, applies here. So it's a very dynamic, a largely asynchronous process, is that a lot of this work is done outside meetings, all right? Sometimes even 24 hours of the day, all right? Currently, I would say we're probably handling somewhere between 200 and 250 bugs per month on HTML5. So it's a very large project, a lot of people making comments, and it requires a large number of people in the working group watching what's going on.
In the line of the previous question, you mentioned also that part of your time you spend it preparing or working on a testing infrastructure. Can you dive some more into that concept?
Yes. One of the important things that the W3C tries to do is to achieve interoperability between implementations, whether it's XML, XML schema, XHTML, or HTML5. So when I got involved in the working group in a year and a half ago, one of the things that I tried to do right away was to get the working group to start working on a test suite. That test suite would actually be used during the W3C stage that's called candidate recommendation, which comes after last call. So we're probably about a year away from actually needing the test suite in our day-to-day work, but we've already started to build the test suite, build a test harness. And of course, this is the point that you made earlier about bringing the community together. Well, we have a large number of different companies. Mozilla tests their software different than IE tests our software. So we have to find some sort of infrastructure that would actually allow us all to use this test suite. All right? So, yes, it's very important. We currently have about 1,000 approved tests in the test suite. We have another 20,000 tests that have been recently submitted. And we have a testing task force. So it's a subgroup in the working group that meets separately. And they're responsible for setting up that framework, getting agreement across companies and participants, going out and evangelizing the need. And that's one thing I want to encourage anyone, all web developers, is to go to the W3C website, find the HTML working group page, and find the testing page. And we're very open to other people just submitting tests using the infrastructure that we're setting up. I won't be very surprised if a year from now, when we start to move to that stage where we're actually testing implementations, that we may have 75,000 tests in the HTML5 test suite. CSS 2.1, the cascading style sheet specification, which is just about to be finalized by the W3C, has 9,000 tests in its test suite. So I think you can see, with HTML5 being so much larger, that in order to be able to test it comprehensively and to prove that you can use the same content across multiple different user agents, we need a very large test suite. which is why we started it over a year ago and are making some progress even in advance of needing it at the W3C.
Okay, let's move into more delicate points, for example. What would you say is the main message that you're bringing here to Spain? What's the main point that you're going to explain this evening?
Well, I think I have two messages. One with my W3C hat on and one with my Microsoft hat on. So I do the W3C one first. So the W3C has become completely convinced that the open web platform, which includes HTML5, CSS, all of the API work, and the ECMAScript work, which is done in ECMA, the protocol work that's done in IETF, is a game-changing technology that is going to allow us to build very innovative and powerful websites going forward. We're going to see a lot of movement towards HTML5 applications. And probably 2 to 3 years from now, they'll start to have as much capability as what we sometimes refer to as native applications do today, whether it's on the PC platform or your mobile platform, whether it's your phone or tablet device. So one of my messages is HTML5 is very important. The W3C is the place where a lot of that work is done. And the advisory committee meeting, which I've been attending in Bilbao, is again an example of the W3C bringing a larger community together. So this was one of the first W3C AC meetings, advisory committee meetings, where we've actually had what I refer to as the commercial media companies involved. So Disney was at the AC meeting for the first time. Sony has recently rejoined the W3C. LG was there. Many of the phone companies, Nokia, Ericsson, AT&T, were all there. So I think what you're seeing in the W3C is a large number of those convergent users of HTML all gathering around the table. Comcast, which is one of the largest cable companies in the United States, is now a W3C member because they see video, one of their main transmission, will not only be to televisions but to remote devices which are actually running browsers. So one of the main messages, I want to encourage web developers to look at W3C as one of the main places that they should get information about that open web platform. Now, from Microsoft's point of view, I've been working with the Internet Explorer team for about 2 years now through the development of IE8, IE9, and now our first platform preview of IE10. I think from Microsoft's point of view, we're heavily committed to the process in the W3C, as well as in ECMA and IETF, where it's appropriate to do those technologies and other standards orgs. But I think one of the things that's extremely important from Microsoft's point of view is to understand that these specifications, how mature are they? How stable are they? And we're being very, very careful that we're not just in a foot race to be the first to do something. That in effect, for our customers, we believe it's extremely important that we implement the specifications when they become stable enough that web developers can really depend upon. So from Microsoft's point of view, we want to encourage web developers to look at our platform previews. We're now providing them every 10 to 12 weeks with new features. So we implemented 3 or 4 new CSS specs in the first platform preview of IE10. And we're going to continue to do more. But we have locations like HTML5labs.com where we're building prototypes of things, which I think you should expect are going to appear in Internet Explorer and in other browsers. Things like IndexedDB, which is a client database. Very simple, just key value pairs, so that in effect, if you have a application that requires a small database on the client, you would actually have an application program interface, an API, to allow you to do that. So from Microsoft's perspective, we're all into doing the work at the W3C, but we also think it's very important that people understand that the specs are at different levels of stability. And from our perspective, we're implementing and trying to achieve interoperability with the other browser vendors as those specs become more and more mature.
Can you give us some insight about the adoption and the Microsoft position of this new standard, and how long is it going to take?
Oh, I think my answer to the previous question, where we now see not only that we have all of the largest user agents or browser representatives at the table, but now we're starting to have the people that own some of the video assets that are very important, the mainstream entertainment broadcast type companies. So I think companies like Sony and LG are there because they're trying to figure out whether they need to put a browser stack in their TVs. All right, we see companies, the automotive industry, becoming extremely interested in HTML as a technology so that they can think about how they're going to adapt their maintenance, their security systems in their automotives, autos to actually use that. So I think W3C is going to become more and more of the place where all of these industries get together to actually try and get agreement on what the future of HTML and the web actually looks like.
We're hearing about these things, about this HTML5 thing. Some people say that this is a way back to JavaScript. Do you think it's really a way back to the old times of JavaScript, about programming, general programming?
You know, that's really interesting. And in one of my previous answers, I said I'm Darwinian when it comes to specifications, because we have good specifications, we have average specifications, but what's really important is adoption, what web developers actually want to use. And I actually think the prevalence of the web, the movement towards having more web-based applications, is making those web applications more and more powerful. And in order to access all of the capabilities on the platform that you're running those applications on, you really need access to the assets of that platform, whether it's geolocation in your phone so you can figure out where the device is, whether it's audio or video or a camera. So I think the natural thing that's actually happening is access to all of those facilities is being done through JavaScript APIs. And I think you'll see, I'm certainly hoping that one of the things that's going to happen, as well as us writing the specifications, is that the tooling, the software development platforms that we have today, whether it's Visual Studio or in an open source environment, something like Eclipse, those tools are going to have to become much more adept at helping developers actually use those APIs. And I think we're a little bit ways away from being able to do that, but I think that's sometimes what happens in the second stage. The second wave will be even better tooling for web developers that are developing HTML applications.
Is the future of the web unblocked? I mean, is the future of the web something that has no extra components related to any page?
No, I'm not sure things like Flash and Silverlight are going to go away. Well, just to go back to my previous answer, I think some of those technologies are very popular today because of the tooling that helps web developers actually build add-ons to their browser to actually use in those technologies. So I'll actually reinforce my earlier message. I think until HTML5 has the tooling that allows native HTML5 apps to compete directly with some of those add-ons, that we're going to continue to see Flash support from Adobe, Silverlight support for Microsoft, and it's going to continue for some time. There are vertical applications for which those are the very appropriate technologies. But I do believe that you will see more and more native HTML applications with, and I think you'll see more browser vendors doing what Microsoft is doing with IE, which is connecting the technology that's in the browser directly to the hardware platform, using the graphics processor to get even better smooth video and better sprite animation, so that you can actually do what many of us call PC-based games directly in HTML. But I think we're a little bit away from doing that. Technology will help, development tools will help, and finishing the specifications will help as well, because of course what developers want is to be able to write an HTML5 application which is going to run cross-browser. And until we get the specifications to be stable so that we get the same implementation effect from all the browsers, we're still a little ways away there as well.
Have you heard something about an initiative called the WinC++ and XML at the time of building interfaces and applications for native devices?
We were talking earlier about the community at the W3C. One of the new kinds of members at the W3C are what I think you and I would call PC gaming companies, who have traditionally aimed their games at a native application that runs, say, on the Windows platform or the Macintosh platform. Well, they've now joined the W3C because they're starting to see a real opportunity for doing games in HTML5. So they're starting to see the kinds of things that IE is doing with hardware acceleration of graphics as something that means that, gee, some of these games are going to be able to be rich enough to be cross-platform, cross-browser, all written in HTML5. And so I think that's a really new opportunity, and maybe they're at the forefront of something new. Not all of them are there, but we're starting to see some of these new companies actually joining W3C because they see that it's really important that they're in these working groups to try and influence the specifications.
And what about ECMAScript 5? I believe it's something that goes in parallel with HTML5, but it's not being prepared or getting ready in the same place. Do you have some kind of coordination?
So when we shipped IE9, we actually put a new JavaScript engine into our product. And our standards and interoperability effort at Microsoft involves several different divisions inside Microsoft. So the JavaScript team is actually in our server and tools division. Obviously, Internet Explorer is over in the Windows division. But when we ship Internet Explorer, we combine those two technologies together. And in fact, my team's a third part of that, because my team owns the responsibility inside Microsoft for the World Wide Web Consortium. So we all work together. So I've been to several TC39 meetings where ECMAScript is actually done. A year and a half ago, we had joint meetings between TC39 and the HTML5 committee, because we had some technical problems that we wanted to solve between the two. And so not only do the people in Microsoft work together, but the committees themselves, which have representatives across many different companies, also need to work together as well. Well, I think what he's trying to impress upon the people that are looking at browsers like IE9, that they take advantage of the facilities in the platform that they run on. All right, that in effect you're not developing a browser that is what you might call the least common denominator, but that in effect the browser knows the platform that it's running on. In the case of IE9, it knows it's running on Windows 7, and it takes advantage of the capabilities that are in that platform. It can see down through the operating system all the way to the hardware so that it can actually drive the graphics processor to actually accelerate the experience and the capability of the web page or the web application that's actually being shown to the user.
One of the big problems for people are the so-called state development related features. Which is, you can use something like Modernizer to magically enable that thing, that HTML thing in other browsers. And I'm talking about local storage, session storage, file API, WebSQL API, WebSockets, Office apps, all that. How is your message about that?
I mean, some of those specifications are fall into very different categories. So for instance, the WebSQL one, I actually think that's going to be a species that dies off. Following my earlier evolution metaphor, I think the browser vendors have more or less agreed that the specification of choice for a client database is going to be IndexedDB. All right, and in fact, I think that inside the W3C, the work on the web SQL specification is just not going forward. All right, file API. From a W3C point of view, it's getting to be more and more stable. We have a prototype on html5labs.com, and I think you can expect to see it in IE at some point in the future. So, and there were several other specs that you mentioned, which I think are going to become more and more mature, all right, more stable, and you'll see more and more of those actually arriving. WebSockets is a really, really good example of one of those specs, because I sometimes say to developers, I ask them, what do they think the most interesting, innovative part of HTML5 is? And when they ask me that question, I say WebSockets. Then I ask them, what's the most dangerous part of HTML5? And I say WebSockets. And so people have, and it's all about stability. So the WebSocket specification started in the W3C. The protocol was moved to the IETF because that's where web protocols are really done. The API remains in W3C. But the protocol is now in its seventh version. All right. Over the last 6 or 7 months, they're producing a new, more secure, more robust protocol on a very regular basis. So there's an example of a specification that's just not quite stable enough. And in fact, given that the protocol has changed so much, the API specification in the W3C now needs to be aligned with the new protocol, and that work is still pending as well. So from Microsoft's point of view, we're not going to implement that specification in our platform until we think it's stable enough that we've decreased the risk for developers. So there's a large number of those specifications that were in your list, which are on different levels of that maturity scale. And I think that you're going to see more and more of those arrive in all of the browsers. And I would think, you know, by a year from now, when we get to candidate recommendation, you'll see those, many of those, maybe not WebSQL, because I think it's been usurped by IndexedDB. I think you're going to see most of those in the browsers, either in prototype form or even in shipping in order to test them in candidate recommendation stage at the W3C.
What would you say is more future-oriented, in a way? WebMatrix with Razor or ASP.NET?
You know, I've had a long career in computer science technologies, and both in the database area and now in the web-centric technologies. And I nearly always answer that question the same way. I tell people to use the one that they know best. All right, that in effect, sometimes it's more important that you actually understand the technology than it necessarily be the best hammer to hit the nail. All right, and so I don't think there's a single answer there. I think that there's lots of interesting frameworks for people to use when they're developing web applications. And I would really encourage web developers to look broadly amongst all of the technologies that are available. But when it really comes down to being successful at a web developer, it's nearly always those developers that are successful are the ones that really know how to use their tools well. All right, and so I shy away from picking A or B, and I encourage people to really become experts on one or two of them so that they can really shine.
And finally, what's the role of Silverlight 5 besides the Windows Phone 7 thing, if it has any role?
I don't think technologies like Silverlight are going to go away anytime soon. I think there are applications that Silverlight is for quite some time going to be a quite appropriate technology for people to use in add-ons in the browser environment. I mean, HTML4 had the object tag, which allowed us to do things like video and audio. Well, HTML5 actually has a video tag and an audio tag, right? So in some ways, they're replacements for something that was already there. The object tag's not going to go away, all right? And people will continue to use that. And I think that, but then again, I'm Darwinian here, right? And really what will happen is whatever the best tooling, whatever the best experience, whatever is the broadest cross-browser experience will probably be what attracts developers. They have to compare that broad experience to the technology capabilities that they get with some of the add-ons like Silverlight and Flash. And I expect that some people will opt for one and some people will opt for the other. But I certainly think in the case of Silverlight, there's very strong usage patterns today that people are going to continue to use it for. I think that desire to have portable applications is very important in today's heterogeneous platform world. I think they're obviously going to be developers that are going to look to get the most number of platforms covered. I mean, it's one of the reasons why Microsoft moved IE9 to the Windows Phone. Obviously, we want to encourage people to use IE9, and we want to encourage developers to feel that they have the same experience using IE9, whether it's on the Windows platform or the Windows Phone platform. And I think that you're going to see other platform vendors, as I would call them, do the same sort of thing. All right, and because obviously, from an application developer's point of view, he wants his website to be available through as many different browsers and devices, but he wants his web app to be as available as well. And I think that's one of the main promises of HTML5, is that you actually see startups now where their whole single idea is to do HTML5 applications. And the reason that they can do that is because they see a very rich, heterogeneous set of platforms that those applications are going to be able to run on.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for your words, and I hope your stay in Spain is really great, and maybe we can see you again soon.
Well, it's very enjoyable. I've been to Spain a couple times before. Beautiful weather this week, very, very nice. But I think from W3C's point of view, when Sir Tim Berners-Lee founded the organization, it was to make the web successful. And I think HTML5 is just another example of the W3C being really successful with the support of a large and ever-increasing set of members that are all really interested in building the open web platform.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.